Case number 24-0039, Kenneth Rosenbaum versus Stephen Samler.
Good afternoon. My name is Sanjay Taylor. I'm the presiding justice of the Sixth Division of the First District Appellate Court. I'm joined by my colleagues, Justice Michael B. Hyman and Justice Carl A. Walker. If I can ask counsel to introduce themselves, and each of you will have 20 minutes to present your arguments. For the appellant, if you would let me know how much of your 20 minutes you would like to reserve for rebuttal, I would appreciate that. So, counsel for appellant.
Good afternoon. Marcos Riley for appellant Kenneth Rosenbaum, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Riley. And counsel for appellee.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Ryan Williams on behalf of appellees, cross appellants, Stephen Samler, Leah Samler, Eli Samler, and Jesse Samler. And Your Honors, just for clarification, as a cross appellant, may I also reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, how much would you like?
I would like 3 minutes, please.
Good afternoon, Ms. Williams. Mr. Riley, you may begin.
May it please the court. This is an appeal from the dismissal of the Second Amended complaint under 2615 and 2619. The initial complaint was never served or responded to. Therefore, plaintiff only had two chances to plead. No discovery was conducted, and the defendants never answered the allegations. There is a cross appeal, as noted. The cross appeal is from the denial of a sanctions motion. The issues overlap substantially, since if the pleading should not have been dismissed, then I think it follows logically that there should not have been sanctions granted. So I'm going to discuss this with reference to the appeal. It is, of course, well established that while Illinois is a flat fact pleading jurisdiction, it's not necessary to plead evidence, only
Let me ask
ultimate
you a
facts.
question.
Yes.
Why isn't it at least plausibly privileged, the two letters, so-called demand letters? I know you disagree with that, but the letters written by the two lawyers.
Why aren't they privileged? Well, I think that's an issue of fact under the Horwitz case. The Horwitz case specifically says that an attorney may be an independent party whose judgment breaks the chain of causation, but that is dependent on the facts. And if
That's
the
not how the
attorneys.
courts have addressed the issue. I mean, it, under your reasoning, there would always be a fact question, and that isn't how the courts have addressed this issue. It's if it is a letter that comes within the privilege, which it can be determined on the facts in the complaint, then the claim shouldn't proceed. That's why you file a motion to dismiss.
Well, respectfully, there is an inherent fact question when agency is the basis for dismissal. And also, these letters were not sent during the pendency of any litigation.
But
And there's a.
that's a demand letter. It doesn't have to be. You know that.
If it's necessarily preliminary, that's correct. If it's not, then it isn't. And if it's a
Well, it
demand letter.
wasn't it preliminary? I mean, there was a lawsuit that followed, and weren't these involved in that? What happened later on? I mean, it's a lawyer. There's a reason we have that privilege. It's a very important privilege for all lawyers. And aren't you actually saying that you're weakening it if we agree with you?
Well, I'm certainly not saying it's not an important privilege, and I am a lawyer, and I do agree with that. I think, however, that the circumstances have to be looked into individually, and whether or not the fact that a lawsuit followed doesn't necessarily mean the letter was preliminary to a lawsuit. It is
But
pled
can't
here
a
that there are
judge
other
determine that
motivations.
based upon the contents of the letter and the allegations in the complaint? And that's why we have motions to dismiss.
That's a fair point, Your Honor, but the context is important. And
What's different in this context from any other context, considering that lawyers were not employees of these
that's true.
people? Okay,
That's true.
so they're agents, which is typical. Very rare is it going to be employees, but it happens. So I'm just trying to find out, why this case is different from all the other cases.
Well, I can't speak to all the other cases, but this
Well,
case is.
how you have to differentiate in some way.
In this case, one key fact that's different is that Mr. Stephen Samler had direct contact with his mother's estate planning lawyer before any of the letters were sent, and that attorney, who was the only person with knowledge, told him that there was no undue influence by my client,
Well, and that's
Mr.
right, but
Rosenbaum.
the attorney also suggested that he hire an attorney and investigate, which is really what he was doing. But I will tell you what I'd like to discuss just a little bit here, that and there's probably no wrongdoing here in this particular case. I want to be clear about that. Probably none. That's where this is right now. But we're talking about a situation where previously the grandchildren were entitled to receive 95% of the estate. And then all of a sudden, the investment advisor is now getting 40% of the estate. Any person in this state would have contacted a lawyer, started an investigation, and decided that, well, let's look into this. And to me, that's all that was going on, is that they were looking into this. It turned into a lawsuit, and that lawsuit was subsequently dismissed. But I'm disturbed by this. So what I'd like to ask you to do is to kind of take us forward is just tell us that we've got nine arguments here that we need to deal with. What are the two or three arguments that you really believe you prevail
With respect to the privilege,
on with respect to the entire case?
well, I think the defamation claims are the strongest. I think with respect to the privilege, that it certainly it is legitimate to hire an attorney to investigate. And if you knew nothing else but what they put in their letters and their pleading, that would be arguably a reasonable course of action. But they knew more. They knew about the pre-existing personal relationship. They knew that Mr. Rosenbaum didn't cash all those checks that he was sent. They acted as if he did. It's a very unusual situation for a person to have tens of thousands of dollars in checks which they don't cash. That indicates strongly he did not have a motive to seek financial favor or take advantage of Mrs. Samler. They also didn't investigate by talking to the estate planning lawyer. The attorneys who they hired disregarded the letter, and the reason for that is likely, as we've alleged, that Mr. Samler never told them about the letter. They were
Yeah, but the
unaware
letter
that.
is just as Walker has indicated. I mean, the letter is not the end all of this case, and so that seems to me the not to be a very good road to follow. But I want to get back to you say the most important thing that you is the defamation per se and per quad. You're saying that that's your strongest case, and which letters are you talking about?
Well, there are three letters. There's the Goldberg letter, there's the first Witzer letter, and then there's the second Witzer letter. Although those are not the only defamatory communications, because as we pled, Stephen Samler communicated directly with Oppenheimer and with FINRA, and his communications made it onto FINRA's website for anyone to see. And the second
Oh,
Witzer
but
letter.
that's not his doing. And the fact that he communicated, again, the law doesn't seem to support you. That's a quasi-judicial body.
Well, it is pled that he expected and intended the
Well,
publication as a result of what he did.
so intent. Where in the law does it say in defamation intent? We should look at intent. Do you have a case that says that?
I don't have a case that says publication is a matter of intent, but I think that it's common sense if you're claiming there's no
No
publication, then
common
somebody
sense. No common
intended.
sense. We need to go on the law, okay?
Well,
You're
yes.
saying it was intent. It's not common sense. The no case says intent is common sense. This is an issue. This is an important issue. So tell me why intent is it involved here?
If you have a strategy to publish a defamatory remark and you do it in a way that you know it will be published, I don't think you can escape liability, or at least the possibility of liability, for the consequences of your
If
actions.
there's a defamatory statement, and I mean that's a question.
That's a different
It's a
question,
different
correct.
question. But let's talk
Mr.
about.
Riley, where do you draw the line between someone who's got a legitimate beef and someone who is seeking to defame? My concern here is that if we were to rule in your favor, we would disincentivize clients from bringing wrongdoing to the regulator, FINRA. Where do you draw that line?
Well, I think that's a fact-based analysis, Your Honor, and respectfully, I think intent does play into it and context plays into it, and you have to the court to make that determination has to take cognizance of everything that was reasonably known to the person who made the complaint at the time that they made it and their motivation, which is a maybe a matter of inference, but you can make inferences from circumstantial evidence. You can't do that at the pleading stage.
Well, so if the client here felt that he was wronged, that the financial advisor violated some rules or laws, and the fact that maybe he even wanted to see that the advisor was punished for those wrongs, does that, you know? That's protected, isn't it? That wouldn't be subject to defamation simply because he wanted to see the person punished.
Well, I think that the motivation is separate from the effect, but I think it's clearly defamatory to accuse a financial advisor of taking advantage of a client. There is, in fact, a criminal statute that makes it a crime. It's also an imputation of professional dishonesty and lack of ethics.
But we're not
And
talking about a criminal, we're not calling criminal here, undue influence. And that's exactly what Justice Taylor's talking about. People find these situations all the time and report them. And that's exactly what was done here. They had a belief of undue influence and they wanted it investigated. Now it was later dismissed. But still, that in and of itself, again, without that intent, I don't see where that gets you, and I don't think you've really addressed Justice Taylor's question.
Let me just follow up. Let's take it one step further. We have a regulator for lawyers in the state. If we were to rule in your favor, that would disincentivize clients from bringing wrongdoing to the regulator for lawyers, the ARDC, because they might be exposed to claims of defamation.
Well, I think lawyers are maybe a special case, and this is not obviously an ARDC case. There is obviously an incentive that goes both ways, and the privilege is addressed to not disincentivizing it. Particularly, it started out with counsel, not encouraging counsel to be zealous and not disincentivizing them by penalizing them. But on the other hand, the privilege is not supposed to be a free pass for any kind of malicious conduct, and the mere hiring of an attorney is not, I don't think any case holds, just sufficient as an inherent defense to absolve the client from any responsibility for the attorney's actions, especially if the client is essentially the puppeteer and the attorney's the puppet, and the client's telling the attorney only what he wants the attorney to know, and personally intervening and communicating. I would also say that they didn't just ask for an explanation. They filed a lawsuit and they made the same accusation. And then, in the face of a summary judgment motion, they had no evidence. They produced no evidence. They did not
Well, that
respond and they
lawsuit is
lost.
over. They lost. This case is not about that lawsuit.
It's all a continuing course of conduct. This
No,
case,
it
it, to
isn't a
the
course of conduct. You filed a separate action. We're there. That case is not before us. That's a final
well,
judgment.
That's true, Your Honor, but we are suing for malicious prosecution and abusive process. To that extent, it is.
And yes, you are. But tell us how you've met the standard there, and particularly. Where the damages that you seek are attorney fees, and there is no case that says the American rule doesn't apply. And in this situation, the cases you cite talk about legal malpractice cases where attorney fees are provided for, but this isn't a legal malpractice case. And so, with regard to that claim, which would fall because of the def if the defamation claims fall. Tell us how that claim even gets to us.
Well, I agree.
Gets past the motion to dismiss.
I agree with you that there is no case on point. There is no case that holds that attorney's fees can be special damages for purposes of the malicious prosecution claim. There's also no case that holds that they can't. So there has
Well,
to
I
be
think
some
you
kind of an
can, and that
inference.
you can say that they can't, because in no case they has, and we're this is not something that's brand new out of the box, and so I don't think it's a question of first impression. You haven't said that in your brief, so there is no precedent, and if you have none, if there is anything, tell us. Tell anywhere in the country. Let us know right now. Is there? If you had it, you would have, I'm sure, cited it.
That's right. And I looked. However, there's several different categories of attorney's fees that the trial court blended together. It's not only fees incurred in defense of the plaintiff in the previous cause of action. He was forced to pay his employer's fees, and he had to pay
But
fees to
again,
respond to
though,
FINRA.
that's typical. As an attorney, you know, sometimes you have other counsel that represent other parties, and there's agreements, a joint defense, or payment of costs, or maybe he has a contract. Whatever it is, that doesn't. There's no cases that those types of costs are recoverable.
I have not found any. I haven't found any to say that they're not either.
As far as your damages are concerned, there isn't any precedent.
That's a fair statement, Your Honor.
Well, thank you.
So we're at about 15 minutes now. I wanted to reserve a little bit for rebuttal. If anybody has questions, I'm happy to answer, but just want to make that point.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Riley. Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. And I very much appreciate your time in hearing this case today. Your Honors, this case involves a father and grandchildren who merely had the temerity to question why their loved mother and grandmother, who was in excess of 100 years old, why her trust came to be changed such that her stockbroker became a 40% contingent beneficiary in that trust. And so, what did this?
But dear clients, I mean, there was no evidence. According to the complaint, there's no evidence. Her attorney said she was competent. I mean, and I'm sure her son and the grandchildren knew the type of personality she was. She sounded like a very strong-willed individual and competent till the end, from what is in the complaint. And that we heard repeatedly about withholding facts from counsel. Doesn't that's not showing any kind of good faith here.
Well, Your Honor, so Justice Hyman, I believe that what this family did, and in particular the father, did what any reasonable family would do under the circumstances, and that's that they went out and they sought the advice of counsel. They, M
But
Mr.
why didn't he tell him about the letter from her, Mr. Shapiro?
Well, so first and foremost, Your Honor, that is nowhere alleged in any of their complaints. The only place where that allegation is made is actually in their proposed third amended complaint, where they ask the court for reconsideration and for leave to file the third amended complaint. That comes from, my understanding at least, is that it comes from to Justice Taylor's point, it comes from an ARDC complaint that was filed against the attorney who filed this lawsuit on behalf of the Samlers, seeking a declaration of undue influence. And so that fact is nowhere alleged other than in a proposed Third Amendment complaint, first and foremost. And in addition to that, Your Honor, I think that to the circuit court's point, this letter that is relied upon so heavily, where Louis Shapiro, the estate attorney, said, to my knowledge, there wasn't any undue influence, isn't really as advertised. This isn't a situation where Mr. Shapiro said there wasn't any undue influence. I was the only person involved in all these discussions, and I can say with 100% confidence there wasn't any. He said, to my knowledge, there hasn't been any. And so this highly qualified statement as contained in this letter, as the circuit court held, it most certainly shouldn't be afforded the importance that the plaintiff seeks to place on it.
Well, what about the fact that it's in accepting what you're saying? Okay. So it's in the Third Amendment complaint, which the court did not allow to be filed. Shouldn't we allow the Third Amendment complaint because of that allegation and some of the others that they make? I mean, even if we agree with everything you say, isn't it make sense in light of what you just said that we allow the Third Amendment complaint to be filed and considered by the court?
So, no, Your Honor, and here's why. I mean, ultimately, whether leave is granted to file this Third Amendment complaint is soundly within the discretion of the Circuit Court. And the Circuit Court did not abuse its discretion in terms of denying leave to replead. There is no, so let's go to the
Well,
back.
that's the question. I mean,
Yes, so.
why is it, but judges give more than two chances on a lot of times. Why, in this case, when they have something new to say, shouldn't wouldn't it be abuse of discretion not to give them another chance?
No, Your Honor, and here's why. Because ultimately, we have to look at the factors, right, for whether leave to replead is properly denied. And so, ultimately, here there are two factors in particular that I think are particularly pertinent. Timeliness, being the first. Ultimately, the three new paragraphs that go into this Third Amendment complaint. They could have been brought up with the court prior to the court issuing its dismissal order with prejudice. There is no reason why those facts could not have been alleged via the Second Amendment complaint, and they were not.
Well,
In
but
addition,
isn't it the real issue here that the court pointed out the deficiencies in the complaint, and the amended complaint didn't address those deficiencies?
that's exactly where I was going to go next, Your Honor. Thank you. That's exactly correct. There are three new paragraphs that are added to this Third Amendment complaint. None of those three paragraphs address any of the deficiencies with the Second Amendment complaint. And with the First Amendment complaint, ultimately being dismissed without prejudice, plaintiff and his counsel having a very clear roadmap as to all of the various deficiencies, and things that could not be pled around at all. For instance, absolute litigation privilege. The circuit court held that that privilege applied to these attorney drafted sent communications. And if that privilege applies, malice, all it doesn't matter with what intent the letters are sent. All that matters is that the privilege applies. So to Your Honor's point, those three paragraphs that were added, they do nothing to save this Third Amendment complaint. They don't address any of the issues that were previously raised by the circuit court.
So let me just
And
take it another direction really quickly,
yes.
because though the overall facts in this case still disturb me greatly, Mr. Riley is arguing that to some extent and to a large extent, that your client has accused him of committing a crime. And therefore, his position is that the complaint should go forward because he believes, I believe he said, that he believes defamation is his strongest argument here.
So, Judge, to that point, first and foremost, so number one, really, that's a question of whether it's defamation per se or defamation per quod, right? In terms of whether a crime is alleged. The statute that they say would show that undue influence is a crime, it very specifically deals with concepts like withholding food, withholding funds, various things that are nowhere alleged that Mr. Samler said with respect to, and frankly, it's not alleged Mr. Samler said anything with respect to Mr. Rosenbaum. All that's alleged is that the attorneys said various things via these demand letters. But ultimately, that's not really the issue, whether it's defamation per se or defamation per quod, because ultimately, the absolute litigation privilege is plainly applicable to these letters, to these demand letters that serve as the basis for the defamation claims. And so, whether defamation per se, whether defamation per quod, regardless of the intent in sending those letters, the absolute litigation privilege very clearly applies if, in fact, the letters are simply pertinent to the litigation that was ultimately filed. And this pertinency requirement, it is not strictly complied, it is construed in favor of pertinency. And I think there's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I don't even think that Mr. Riley would contend that these letters that deal with this exact concept of undue influence on the grandmother, that that wasn't the exact subject matter of the declaratory judgment action that was ultimately filed against both Oppenheimer and Mr. Rosenbaum.
So,
So,
are you saying that I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I just want to know if your strongest argument is the privilege applies. So we don't even get to the defamation. Okay,
correct among others, but yes.
I know. I'm not saying that's your only argument,
Yes.
but Mr. Riley said his strongest argument that he gave us was the defamation. Okay, so just fallback position. Okay, so if we don't buy the privilege, why? Does it tell us your strongest argument against his strongest argument?
If with
Defamation.
taking out the privilege.
No, taking out the privilege. Yes, taking
Okay,
out.
so taking out the absolute litigation privilege, I think that there are multiple issues with respect to both. So with respect to both defamation per se and defamation per quod. And let me start with defamation per se. So number one, the sole correspondence that I think could even arguably be alleged to have been published to someone, to a third party who was ultimately a defendant in the lawsuit, is that first piece of correspondence. And that the first piece of correspondence, it was sent to Oppenheimer. It said, look, there's a presumption that when a person stands in a fiduciary relationship with a or stands in a fiduciary relationship, as in this instance, a stockbroker with his client, there is a presumption that there is undue influence if there is a financial benefit that goes to that person. That's what the first letter says. Doesn't accuse him of criminal misconduct, anything along those lines. It merely says there's a presumption of undue influence. And ultimately, that letter was sent to Oppenheimer more than a year prior to the filing of this defamation lawsuit. So first of all, we have, is it defamation per se? We would contend it's not. It doesn't accuse him of a crime. It talks about a presumption that gives that is that based on the fiduciary relationship, there's undue influence. Number two, it's time barred by virtue of the 1 year statute of limitations for defamation claims. And ultimately, I think that those are the two big issues with that particular letter. So then we look at the subsequent letter, that the only letter that falls within the statute of limitations, the 1 year statute of limitations. That letter was sent to Mr. Rosenbaum directly. And it CC'd, or I'm sorry. Yes, it was sent to Mr. Rosenbaum directly, and it CC'd Mr. Samler's attorney, which we showed via an invoice, via our 619.1 motion to dismiss, where the invoice shows. Not only was it an invoice to Mr. Samler for legal services from Mark Eisenberg, who CC'd on this second letter, but it is also an invoice that shows that Mr. Eisenberg was speaking with Mr. Weitzker about this undue influence claim and various ways the facts giving rise to it. So ultimately, with respect to the first letter, we find ourselves in a situation where I frankly don't think it can be considered defamation per se to begin with. And number two, it's time barred. And with respect to the second letter, where you need to show for defamation per quod, the letter that falls within the ultimate or that falls within the statute of limitations, even if it is defamation per se, it is ultimately a situation where that letter wasn't published. It simply wasn't published to anyone. It was published to Mr. Rosenbaum. So, and then beyond that, if we're talking defamation per quod, I mean, I think that the law in Illinois is very clear about the damages requirement, the special damages requirement. And it can't just be emotional distress. It can't just be the time in dealing with it. It can't be these vague allegations. It needs to be rock solid special damages. And the only special, quote unquote, special damages that are being alleged are attorney's fees, which under the American rule just simply is not a recoverable special damages the circuit court held. So I will just add, This and I want to shift gears here for a moment to my to the motion for sanctions. And your honors, I truly do not take lightly filing a motion for sanctions. It is not something that I relish at all. But I will say this. If there ever was an instance where sanctions are warranted, this is that instance, your honors. We refrained from doing anything with respect to the first amended complaint. And we put out all the law, the well-known law, including the law surrounding the absolute litigation privilege that has literally come from the Illinois Supreme Court as early as 1870. We put all of this law out there, and the circuit court came back, and we didn't seek sanctions. Even though I felt at that point there really wasn't sufficient due diligence done on this, there wasn't sufficient research done on this, it was absolutely inadequately pled. And some of these claims just simply could never properly be pled in light of the privilege. But we refrained. We then get this detailed, lengthy 13-page opinion from the circuit court that spells out with specificity all of the various issues. It applies the absolute litigation privilege. It points out all of the various issues. It applies Horowitz, for which is a very important case because ultimately the client is never is not in a position to micromanage their attorneys to ensure their attorneys are adhering to their ethical obligations. And so we put all that out there, Your Honors. We get this detailed opinion. And what is the response then to that opinion? It is very simply this: opinion ignored, disregarded. And we're going to assert the exact same claims based on the exact same alleged defamatory communications that the court already held were absolutely privileged. And it wasn't as though there was arguments made of, well, the law should be expanded or there should be an exception. The argument was this: you're wrong, Judge. That was the argument. And then from there, we get another. We get a motion for reconsideration. We
So,
get this.
if I understand your
Yes.
what you're saying is that maybe they should have just left it alone and appealed at that time if they wanted to, but they didn't, and they didn't do much of a difference, and they incurred for your clients a lot of time and money as a result of not doing anything substantive in the Second Amendment complaint. If there had been something substantive, then you're saying there wouldn't be a basis for sanctions, but in the fact that the judge gave it to you and he did a very thorough job in his analysis in dismissing the complaint. So that's your argument. I just want to make sure I.
That's exactly right. And ultimately, to the extent that the argument, and this was the argument, is that just simply you're wrong. We are entitled to our attorney's fees as special damages. There's some the and this was the argument before the circuit court, was that you're wrong. We are entitled to attorney's fees. You're wrong. The privilege doesn't apply. It wasn't as though, oh, well, there's some special exception or there's some there should be some extension. And so to your honor's point, you're absolutely correct. That's exactly why I had to make the difficult decision to file this motion, because from our perspective, the correct posture here would have been to simply say, we disagree and we are going to appeal this, and that's fine. They have an appellate right. They have the right to have your honors review what happened. But to continue forth to file this Second Amendment complaint that the circuit court said is not appreciably different from the first, to file a motion for reconsideration, to seek leave to file this Third Amendment complaint, it all resulted in significant fees to my clients. And I think the only conclusion that it really leads to is that the purpose of this, especially given the complete lack of merits of this case as pled, is that really this case is designed to punish my clients, to cause them financial hardship in light of the fact that they questioned why this trust was changed.
Mr. Williams, you're at time. Is there
Thank you.
anything else you want to say to wrap up?
Yeah, just Taylor, I'd like to ask Mr. Williams to respond to the question that you asked earlier of Mr. Riley regarding what impact this could have on others who may have be in a similarly situated.
So I think that this case could potentially have an enormous impact on many things. To Justice Taylor's point, to reporting to the ARDC, to your point, reporting to FINRA. And FINRA is obviously a very important organization. It's where the SEC does its compliance actions. It is where people go to report incidences to regarding stockbrokers, traders, in terms of times that they felt that they've been harmed or that they've been duped out of money, things along these lines. The ability to report and the ability to go to FINRA, to go to the ARDC, to hire lawyers, to analyze situations and do things within that lawyer's ethical bounds are...
Or even send a letter to Oppenheimer. Just,
correct.
They hit the five.
It is incredibly important.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Williams.
Thank you.
Mr. Riley, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Okay, well, 5 minutes won't do it, but I'll take five. To start with the criminal statute that we've been discussing, this is addressed in my reply brief. It is not correct that the statute confines criminality to cases of coercion. It specifically says, and I cited the section, you can read it for yourselves, instances of undue influence, and they uses that term, by a person who's a fiduciary, are per se criminal. So this is an accusation of criminal conduct. And it's made, the Goldberg letter almost specifically alludes to the statute, although it doesn't cite it. The subsequent letters clearly are addressed to the same thing. Anybody in the financial
the Goldberg
industry
letter,
would know.
We can't even consider the Goldberg letter if the statute ran.
It's a continuing course of conduct.
Where do you get that? It's two different lawyers signing two different
client.
Letters. With regard to the same issues, the same causes of, you know, this the same thing. I mean, it's not a continuance of anything.
Go ahead. Interrupt. It's the same client through different lawyers making the same defamatory accusations as part of a plan to try to discredit my client and damage his reputation with his employer.
Industry. If we don't, what's your best case as to why? I mean, that's your only basis, is it's continuing. Otherwise, the Goldberg letter falls by the wayside, correct?
That's the argument there, but I want to address the other letters because this statement's been made that they only went to my client. It's specifically pled that sending to the letter to him at his office was an intentional ruse to get Oppenheimer to read it, and that they did read it. And this is probably what they consulted with Mr. Eisenberg about, because he's a specialist in the securities industry. They knew that Oppenheimer's compliance department and legal department would see this letter before my client did. And that is, in fact, what happened. And that's
it's
a
either
publication.
Defamation, again, intent. You're going back to the intent that we talked about before. Does the letter have defamation in it? You're saying, well, it's defamatory because of what happened later.
No, I said it's defamatory and he intended it be published. This is the publication element and not the defamation element. They're saying it was not published. I'm saying this is how he published
how
it.
How can anybody control third parties, what might or might not happen? That circumstance, I mean, you're saying it's part of a plot that they cooked up. But again, that's not how the law seems to have developed.
If you know the industry and you know the policy of brokers, you can predict what will happen. And you can certainly predict that a letter like this will go to the compliance department before it goes to the broker. And they knew it. And that's what happened. And that is publication. And getting the same information onto the FINRA website is also publication. They caused it. They communicated it to FINRA knowing it would become public. That is publication. I want to speak for a minute to the sanctions issue. It's rather ironic that the Samwers filed a lawsuit against my client with no evidence whatsoever, nobody asked for sanctions, and yet they think that my client should be sanctioned for trying again one time to replead his case. This is a discretionary decision. It's very clear. Samwers have argued that just because the court didn't articulate reasons for its decision, that makes it arbitrary. The law is very clear that that's not true. Trial court is not required to articulate reasons to deny sanctions, and that is not a reason to overturn the trial court's decision on that issue. I think that's really all that needs to be said about the cross appeal.
Okay.
I think that was about 5 minutes.
You have one more minute.
Well, with respect to...
You don't have to take it, but I'm just telling you, one more minute.
With respect to the privilege, I think the issue is more complicated then can be addressed here, and the court has access to the file. I will say that it is not true that the Second Amended complaint is not different from the First Amended complaint. We actually went to the extent of filing a red line, which is in the court file. With all due respect to the trial court, I think the trial court did not carefully read it and took the Samler's characterization of the pleading as the pleading rather than reading the pleading and taking the pleading as true, which is what a trial court is supposed to do.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Riley from the panel? Okay, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Riley. And Mr. Williams, you have 3 minutes in the reply.
Very good. So I will be very quick about this. With respect to the publishing issue and third parties publishing, or the concept that it's going to be intercepted by someone else, the circuit court very clearly addressed that via the Pop the O'Neill case. That's 313 ILAP 3D 638
Speaking of your, this is not actually sir reply. This is your reply on your
My apologies,
appeal.
Your
So
Honor.
speak to that.
Let me just address then the sanctions issue. Here's the ultimate point. What we did was show temperance, and we ultimately filed a motion for sanctions after the judge's opinion was just completely ignored via the Second Amendment complaint. We filed sanctions in this lawsuit. We sought 137 sanctions from our judge in this lawsuit. What we did not do is exactly what Mr. Rosenbaum did, and that's this. What we did not do is wait, win, and then file a separate lawsuit seeking the reimbursement of our fees incurred in this lawsuit by contending that this lawsuit was malicious prosecution or some form of abusive process. We followed the correct procedure of seeking sanctions in front of our trial court judge, not in filing a separate lawsuit, when that plainly is not the way to seek fees if Mr. Rosenbaum felt that he was harmed.
Okay, any questions of Mr. Williams from the panel? Okay. Okay, thank you, Mr. Riley and Mr. Williams, for your zealous advocacy this afternoon. The matter is submitted, and the court will issue a decision in due course.